everyone. We're excited to be here with you today for ISOC Alive. It's officially Cybersecurity Awareness Month, and we are kicking off the month today with a look at the state of cybersecurity, especially as it pertains to workforce issues. So I'm Kristen Kessinger. I'm Director of Communications at ISOCA. And joining me today is John Brandt, our Information Security Practices Lead at ISOCA. John leads our State of Cybersecurity Research Study, and he is here today to talk about this year's findings and what that means for you as a leader, as an individual in your organization, and as a leader. So hello, John.
Hey, Kristen. Thanks for having me.
Great. Why don't we get started with a quick introduction? Maybe you could tell our community a little bit about your past experience in information and cybersecurity and how you came to this role.
All right, great. Sure thing. So I'm a 20-year U.S. Navy veteran. I started off in RF communications, kind of transitioned into the cyber thing back at the time. Did a lot of, worked with a lot of technology throughout the years. About midway through my career, transitioned from an IT to a cybersecurity. Specific relevant background is security management for 5,100 user, company, multiple networks and whatnot. Joined ISOCA in September of 2014 when we were building out the CSX portfolio. And since then have been engaged in this information security realm, providing thought leadership and supporting our members across the globe.
Great. So you lead our State of Cybersecurity Research, which we released in two parts this year. Today we'll be covering part one, which primarily focuses on workforce and budgets. So let's talk workforce first. We've been talking about skills gaps for almost a decade now. What are your thoughts on that? And are things getting any better?
You know, that's an interesting question. And, you know, I don't really withhold any opinions, right? Because I'm kind of a workforce geek in this regard, and I truly it's a passion of mine. One of the challenges I think right now is it's the misnomer. When we say skills gap, there are some quantifiable shortcomings, and I think as other entities and industry research comes along, what we're finding right now is that there are some notable shortcomings within the workforce, but more importantly, we have a talent shortfall. When we talk about supply demand curve and whatnot, the demand for cybersecurity resources is obviously extremely large, and the pipeline to feed that is not, it's not keeping pace. Now, interestingly enough, is I keep tabs on what's going on there in industry and following some professional social networking things. There, we have some work to do because there are a lot of individuals that actually did, they went and sought out some academic programs or reskilling programs. And for whatever reason, we have people that have these quote unquote tickets, right? Of things that we've said, you know, are beneficial to get into the workforce, and they're sitting on the sidelines, not employed. And so from that regards, like we definitely have some work to do there. I think I would like to also kind of highlight that oftentimes the jobs, this large demand for talent is not at the entry level. And that is also complicating issues because experience has to be grown, right? And at the end of the day, if you come into a reskilling program or you go to a credentialing boot camp or a 2 or 4 year university program, those don't give you experience per se, right? Which is, I think, what kind of speaks to a little bit later in the report with one specific way to kind of account for that.
Mm-hmm. And I think we saw in our survey, it takes a lot of companies, 6 months or more to find qualified candidates for their roles. And companies with unfilled cybersecurity roles are reporting that they're experiencing more attacks. So what do you think are the biggest takeaways for organizations when it comes to either finding or growing those qualified candidates?
So let's talk about, because that was really one of the, it was almost a, it was a conflict, right, in the data, right, where we say, so companies are the things, but they're saying that it's taking long to hire somebody and that, you know, that 6 month number. And we saw some betterments. But when you actually look at how it is that in hiring managers or an organization is saying, these are the things that we consider you to be, quote unquote, well qualified, it's actually not the hard technical skills. And it's this irony of things that, you know, from my perspective, the best thing Isaka and others we could do is continue to drill down to provide some meaningful data and metrics, and hopefully draw some conclusions so that we're making data-informed betterments to programs and hopefully closing this gap. With that said, right, they calls up the big thing was this. We saw this thing about soft skills and this need for it. And to be fair, this is not unique to IT or in the broadest sense or cyber. Like all industries are really challenged with this. So, what is our sphere of influence? Obviously, our membership is IT audit, governance, cybersecurity professionals. That's the kind of the realm that we can help with, at least in the short term. You can't just say, you know, and automatically discount these candidates as not being qualified. And we saw some really powerful industry leaders earlier this year, Greg Tuhill specifically, and Caitlin McGaw, I believe, where, you know, I moderated a panel between them. And I think, and I've heard this point reiterated many times since then throughout this year, another podcast that I follow, where the message is increasingly, we could teach anybody to do some of the technical stuff. And I think that we also, as hiring managers and those that are first line or second line leaders behind them, that, you know, it's to kind of carve out what it is, the shortfall that it is, because cybersecurity is a very broad industry and not everything is super technical. Like there's just so many different components to this.
Right. We have someone in the comments saying, I'd like to find companies willing to give people changing industries a shot, but too few seem to be out there. Do you know, John, why some companies, you know, may be more hesitant to do that and maybe how they can take a different approach?
Well, I think this brings up this point of this, the organizational, they have to own a part of this. And I recall, like, shortly after I got hired at Isaka, there was the first conference I went to. I think it was the last ISRM conference. And it was a keynote type session. And the keynote speaker, show of hands, who in the room actually has a corporate training program? And literally less than half a dozen hands went up in the room. And that really speaks to the underlying problem here is that a company can't say, I want somebody who's done anything and everything under the sun and expect that there's no on the job training component of it. Is there's always this portion of it that's unique to your organization. So regardless if somebody comes from financial to another financial or, you know, another like industry, there's always differences in there. Now, this does cause, I think that there's some issues to be had and things that we're going to have to continue to talk about is through my academic studies, when I was working on my master's, you know, one of the things that came up is from a organizational perspective is that when budgets get tight, historically, it looks like that corporate training budgets are the first to go. So that really begs the question of who's paying for the training in some of these programs and whether it's an organization or operational cost. And if it's the latter, it's probably a little bit more guarded. However, though, then you tend to be a little bit more ad hoc and not really a structured approach, which is the value of what learning professionals, what learning development type professionals bring to any problem set.
Right. Yeah, and if we're not paying for training, we may be paying for the rehiring, because we've seen in the news lately, we've heard phrases like the great resignation and the big quit, tons of people leaving their organizations following the COVID-19 pandemic. Obviously, this makes things even more challenging when hiring cybersecurity professionals already seem to be difficult. So what would you say are organizations' best bets for retaining their top talent?
So, one of the values, right, one of the good things that happened with the pandemic is that it forced leaders to kind of get out of their own way and to kind of challenge norms. And it kind of became survival of the fittest, right? And we'll use remote work specifically here real quick. Is pre-pandemic, remote work was really shunned in a lot of areas. And since then, you know, a lot of those biases that were accompanied with it kind of went by the wayside, because companies were like, oh, wow, hey, listen, not only can we save some costs of having a physical presence, but productivity kind of went up. So I think what we've talked about for a couple of years now is that cybersecurity market in particular has been a seller's market. And I think employers need to increasingly really take that to heart, because it's no longer about the salary. And I've long advocated that the industry cannot sustain this, this outbidding type market that exists there, which is highly specific anyway, dependent, on tangible skills. You know, if you have very fixed something that's just very specific, I think largely you might be a little bit more in the driver's seat. But I think from the various reportings that, I've seen, not specific to our industry, I think employees are getting a little bit more choosy, right? Being more selective, and there's more going into it. And it's not just about the salary. It's, it's this balance that we talk about, and I don't even know. I know work-life balance has been talked about a lot, but there's some interesting perspectives on that, is that that balance only really comes into play, it seems to only come into play for some when it's not really a passion area, because where your passion lies, your energy goes. So that said, right, things that I think are lucrative to anybody in the industry is we are a highly credentialed workforce, and that carries a administrative and a financial burden. So making sure that you're working with your employees, some kind of way to kind of decrease that. And I understand the budgets are tight, probably a little bit more so after the pandemic, depending on what industry you came from. But, you have to account for that time. We can't always say it's on the employee to keep themselves credentialed. I get it. I understand, a lot of these people, our members are very busy, especially those that are more on the incident response side, where it's just you're always in a firefighting mode. But everything about a knowledge worker has a cost, whether it's financial, whether it's time or whatnot. And at some point, I think what we're increasingly seeing is employees are really like, they're to a point where they're being a little bit more selective with where they're trying to go and where their passions lie.
You've been part of our state of cybersecurity research now for a few years. So did anything in particular surprise you this year?
Not really. I think the thing that I'm personally very invested in is really kind of helping nail down where the shortcomings are, Kristen. We have to find a way to get talent into the workforce faster. Make no mistake, right? As a military member, the U.S. military, I am a little jaded in that regard, a little biased, right? Because they can take anybody coming off the street with an aptitude that they verify, they do aptitude assessments, and they could put them into some of the most technical jobs in the world with less than a year and a half's worth of training. And that's extremely on the high end. So I think that apprenticeships are an extremely valuable mechanism. They are one way in there. Obviously, university degrees have a place. And there is value, but I think that especially after a year and a half, you know, coming up on 2 years of a pandemic where a lot of people, you know, their livelihood was really interrupted, I'm interested to see what the decrease, what the decline's going to be. And I did see a statistic. I can't reference what it is, but university enrollments are down. And that is problematic when our research highlighted that a lot of employers still look at or still mandate a university degree. So whereas a lot of the things that various governments across the globe did to combat the pandemic, there's second and third order effects of that that are going to affect everything. And we're seeing that right in the manufacturing front with chip production and whatnot. Well, we're going to see that in the human capital realm too, where now we've really disrupted it, a lot.
Yeah, absolutely. We have one audience question here. Are NIST and NICE standards still valued today?
Boy, that's a good question. We're going to kind of walk the tightrope, so to speak, with that. So NIST and NICE exist largely for the U.S. government, right? They've done a lot of work for public-private collaboration, and in that regard, there is a lot of uptake. They've codified a lot of stuff. They've formalized their processes. They've brought on a lot of talent within the NICE program office specifically. And in that regard, yes, I do think they're value added. For somebody like me, though, and the people that are in the program office, I've had some of these conversations. There is a hesitancy among some to adopt it when we continue to see not a lot of change in the public space, in the government space, right? So it's one of those things it's challenging. There's promise, right? Because across the globe, the cybersecurity framework, there was a lot of uptake in that. You know, because it does provide a framework for a lot of emerging markets or governments to not have to reinvent the wheel. And I think that the more that we kind of move towards some kind of synergy across the globe, the better off we all are. The cybersecurity framework, the NICE cybersecurity framework is one mechanism, right? Obviously, there's, when you start to categorize and create very finite buckets of resources and what those knowledge and skills and competencies that are associated with that, you're not going to get a lot of agreement. In some cases, there are similar things that are happening in the EU, right? ANISA is doing some of their own work. We've had the skills framework for the information age has been out there for a while as well. On that, I think the question is probably a little bit more broad. That is NICE, NIST more relevant today. I think the question is because have we become very too prescriptive in work roles? And when you look at the number of work roles that are associated with the NICE framework, and I have not seen what's going to come out of ANISA yet, I think it creates a larger issue for people that want to then not only once they get in industry, how they basically grow their career and where those on and off ramps are. It's not really, when I do speaking here, I really think that I in some regards, I think the industry's kind of done itself a little bit of a disservice because I broadly look at our industry as in a couple different buckets as being either analysts, engineers, or architects. And truthfully, if you look at open job recs, analyst versus engineer, there seems to be some overlap. And I think that's based on someone's understanding of what it is certain things are trying to do. Last point on this whole thing is that organizational size is going to determine how general or how specific your resources are going to, you know, those responsibilities that they are going to have, right? We all, the smaller the company, the more generalist you historically have been. So there's really no right answer. I think for me is, I'm frustrated that there's a lot of, we continue to see a lot of people talking about, I did this program, I went through this reskilling, or I went to a degree and I can't get a job. And to me that, you know, in that regard, it's so frustrating because skills atrophy is a real thing. And whereas not every degree program is, you know, there's varying amounts of hands-on abilities and whatnot, but any time away from going to work is, you know, unless those individuals are keeping up on their own, and there's a ton of those resources. I see some of our audience here commenting on different things that are out there.
Fernando asks as well, are internships available for established professionals? So maybe things like apprentice programs, or is there anything you're aware of that he might be able to look into?
Most of the apprenticeship programs that I've been aware of appear to be for new people. That there's a challenge too, right? Is I see a lot of value in apprenticeships because I believe our industry, this technical industry, is one that it will be a lot better to give somebody just the amount of information they need, get them in the workforce, and then kind of supplement it with this just-in-time training model. The challenge becomes who's going to oversee that, right? There's no unions for cybersecurity or IT professionals. So that is now all of a sudden, you know, it's becomes a challenge because then there's this bias as to who's running the program and what it is they need. What I would encourage individuals, especially in the U.S. market, you need to look at the state workforce agencies. They're the ones that are getting the workforce innovation funding that flows down from the federal government. I would imagine that there's similar things happening at various other governments. That is a good resource, especially for the underemployed or cadre, because those resources that are available to them. I would say that there's an interesting model that's going on with Google that I think it was actually the article came out pre-pandemic, and I haven't seen a whole lot come out on that since. But that there is, I think that when you have somebody that's more vendor specific, and I don't know that it's really earth shattering in that regard, other than the fact, because it kind of follows what Microsoft did early on, but Microsoft back in the early 2000s was very much a certification machine. One of the things our audience needs to be very aware of, though, is as this industry continues to morph and we see more mergers and acquisitions and cloud adoption, my fear right now is that we're going to go very vendor specific. And then, because if you keep it, you know, the internet was never created to be centralized. That was not what it was supposed to do. And a lot of what we try to do, Kristen, is we kind of focus on the non-vendor specific, right? We're trying to be vendor neutral and everything. And I truly believe like you could teach an analyst to be an analyst based on the data, but depending on what you're doing in a security realm, especially in the controls, the design and the controls aspect, now all of a sudden they're, I think you're going to see this pendulum swing back towards these major players that are offering the bulk of the infrastructure that's out there.
Great. Thank you. And thank you all for joining us today. We will be back later this month to dive into part 2 of the report. So have a great day and happy Cybersecurity Month.
Thanks, Kristen.